Welcome, ladies and gents. This is Lana with a unique show this evening. My guest is known as Reactionary Jew on Twitter. I met him at the MPI conference in DC. You know, the one where five guys made a salute and the video of it was seen across the world? Yeah, he'll share his reaction to that since he was there. He's a Jewish ethno-nationalist, Orthodox traditionalist, and understands that diversity is not a strength. We'll talk about his induction into race realism and his reaction upon discovering the alt-right, Jewish memes and all. I give him a lot of room to talk and present his view and how it connects with the alt-right. He responds to basic JQ talking points commonly heard by European nationalists. There's so much more we could have talked about and we will in the future, but this is a good first start. Is it possible to create a bridge between Jewish nationalists and European nationalists? Is a new generation of right-wing nationalist Jews seeing the possible benefits in such a union? Get comfortable for the next 2 hours. Reactionary Jew up next. Welcome, Reactionary Jew. I know this is going to be a very interesting conversation, especially since you're familiar with Red Ice and the alt-right. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we have a lot we're going to try and cover. So I think we should just really dive in right away and you should share with us, you know, what are your views and how did you come to them as a young Jew?
Well, I guess I'll go through my upbringing. I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish household, which means, you know, traditionally religious, quite socially conservative, and also conservative in the way that Americans consider what conservatism is, not full-blown, you know, racial realism. That would be insane. But on the other hand, my parents were not PC about anything. I wasn't raised, you know, you have to be so sensitive to minority struggles. So I never had any of that. Multiculturalism was, you know, a joke in my household. Like, my dad was talking about how Europe was destroying itself by importing an invasion many years ago. So I never had, you know, total delusions about race, even if I wasn't fully red-pilled. But at the same time, I still was a little uneasy about being fully red-pilled. And I'll walk you through what the process was for me. So this, first actually I'd like to talk a little about in school, what we learned, because I went to a religious Jewish day school. And on the one hand, you know, we did learn in our English studies, and I do wonder who puts this curriculum together, because it's a private school. We learned about the struggle of new immigrants who came to this country and the little ghettos they formed. And that's the European immigrants as well, the Latin immigrants, all the traditional literature that they have carved out in public schools. And I was getting mixed messages because in school they were teaching that, but at home my parents were more conservative. And then in the Hebrew studies, they taught us about Zionism. It was a very sanitized version of Zionism. I'll touch on that later, which I think that in Jewish day schools and just in general, the way we are presented with what Zionism is as a sort of, they use this term national liberation movement, which I prefer to just call it what it is. It's an ethno-nationalist movement.
Yeah.
But we even learned about figures like Meir Kahana. And Meir Kahana is like as radical as it gets. A lot of people call him the Jewish Hitler. I'm not a fan of that comparison for a number of reasons. But when you think of really right-wing Zionists, Meir Kahana is up there. And at least my teacher in seventh grade presented his assassination to us as a tragedy, even though she did say he was kind of out there. So we were learning about Herzl and Jabotinsky. And this was in seventh grade, to give you an idea. And the contradiction between the values at home and the values in school in my English classes regarding immigration and multiculturalism, that did strike me. But the contrast between Zionism and multiculturalism, I didn't really consider the contradiction between those two ideas. But anyway, fast forward a little. In high school, I went to a high school that was not really Zionist because it was a more ultra-Orthodox high school, you know, like they wear the black hats.
Sure.
And those Jews are actually surprisingly, they see Zionism as sort of a distraction. They have institutions in Israel. They have educational centers there. But they think that really a focus on nationalism takes Jews away from their primary religious purpose, even if they're not actively opposed to it. They're also coming from a background where their particular subsect of Jews is reacting very strongly to the Jewish Enlightenment in Europe, to secular Zionism, which they really see as a negative thing. So today they see now a lot of religious Jews are establishing things in Israel, but back then they still have this holdover from this is a really negative, potently negative thing. Now, just because they weren't really for it doesn't mean they were against it, but it wasn't a focus during high school, although my parents were still very Zionist during that time. So I would hear about the news in Israel very sympathetically. But anyway, fast forward a little. Once I started entering college, I started becoming very interested in religious topics, in philosophy, in science, and I sort of put politics on a total hold. In many ways, I was an anti-pragmatist. I was just interested in my ivory towers. And I'm glad I went through that phase, but it was what it was. But then during the 2016 election, that was the first time that I was seriously looking at an election. I had followed the Romney election, but I wasn't nearly as invested as I was, even from the beginning of the primaries in the 2016 election. And I thought Trump at the beginning, I thought he was a total joke. I thought he had no idea what he was doing, that he had no concrete policy proposals. And I couldn't understand how people could support him during the primary. Not because I thought building a wall was evil, not because I thought that protectionism was inherently bad, but just because he himself, his persona, I saw as absurd. So I had this friend who's actually, he's always been right-wing. I don't want to say what profession he's going into. He's one of the Jews that I've been talking with extensively, who now shares my full views. He's a very good friend of mine. But the kind of field that he's in, the education that he's pursuing, a New York Jew from a middle-class or upper-middle-class background, you expect him to be this total liberal cosmopolitan elite. But after the Romney election, he started reading Pat Buchanan and Jared Taylor, and he became, you know, fully red-pilled. Mm-hmm. And he was supporting Trump from the beginning of the primary, and I had to ask him. I was a Cruz fan back then because I was looking for an intellectual framework for conservatism, and the sort of National Review type of audience provided me with that. And it was not really attached to reality. In hindsight, I see that now. These ideas of free market, I actually prefer a more, you know, laissez-faire economic approach. I haven't become a socialist with my foray into the alt-right. But at the same time, I recognize that just these ideas alone, without some sort of grounding in what a civilization and a tradition means, can totally take your society off the rails. And I didn't grasp that at the time. That's why I supported Ted Cruz. I thought he was, you know, the really anti-establishment, conservative hardliner. And I told my friend, you know, like, how could you support Trump? And I think he understood it's very hard to convey ideas like this when someone is so rooted and they're not red-pilled on race, and they sort of see any appeal to race as they react very negatively to it. He was trying to explain to me the sort of trust that people had in politicians and how it was totally eroded, and Trump represented someone who was not going to give people the same policies over and over. And he linked me, because we were talking about free speech at the time, he linked me to American Renaissance. And he said, you should read some of their articles. Like, this might make you understand a little more. And I looked at American Renaissance, and at first I thought it was, you know, some conservative publication, but I started reading through it, and then I realized what exactly it was about. And at the time, now I look back at American Renaissance, as much respect as I have for it, it's like pretty centrist or even left-leaning on its approach.
Yeah, I mean, Jared has mentioned too that he has several Jewish friends that have been a part of American Renaissance since the beginning. So,
yeah, and but even aside from, let's say, the Jewish question, American Renaissance is still very libertarian in terms of its approach to policy.
It's true.
But at the time, you know, for me, looking at that, and they made distinctions between race and IQ, I don't get triggered. Even back then, I didn't get triggered. But I definitely, like, this is kind of fringe stuff. This is a little ridiculous. And I'd been exposed to race realism before when it came up on Reddit. And I was like, oh, these clowns again. But eventually, and this was back at the time, since I was exploring conservative ideology, I was watching some of these, you know, anti-feminist, anti-social justice YouTubers. They were to the left of me, but I thought that they explored some of these topics in an interesting way. In hindsight, I think they're a bunch of leftists. But at the time, I was watching Sargon of Akkad, you know?
Who Sargon is. We know who he is.
And he had this debate with Millennial Woes on a Hangout, and also a standalone debate.
I've seen it, yeah.
And I remember watching both of those. And I think it was in the Hangout. I'm not sure which one specifically, but I think it was in the Hangout. One of the people was trying to explain to Sargon that your race or your people, the group that forms your identity, is part of an extended family. And it's totally natural to care about them before you care about other groups. And that doesn't mean you hate other groups. And Sargon, you know, just being and stuck in this liberal mindset, and by liberal I mean classically liberal encompassing American conservatism, for example, where you cannot distinguish between citizens. Citizens are citizens regardless of what their genetics or identity or anything are.
Right.
And yeah. And that's when I realized that I was raised with a tribal identity as part of an extended family, because in our education, these things were taken for granted, that we're part of a nation that has a historical trajectory and that we should care specifically about the destiny of that historical trajectory. One of the great ironies for me, actually, is I see so many on the alt-right, they say things like Jews are ethnocentric and they're insular. It's almost like an insult or a slur. I think it's pointing out the double standard, which is fair. But I love those things about us. I love that word, ethnocentric.
Of course, right?
And when I grew up, you know, most of my friends, most of the people I was exposed to, most of my family friends, and I didn't even realize it. I just took it for granted as a fact of life. Most of everyone that I associated with in every context were overwhelmingly Jewish. And that was when something clicked for me. I wasn't immediately convinced that the alt-right was correct about tribal identity. But that was when I realized that it's not just something crazy or evil or, you know, they hate everyone. There is something that needs to be explored here. And then I went back to Ameren and I started reading articles there and I started watching Jared Taylor's speeches and other Ameren speeches on YouTube. And within, I'd say, a month, maybe a little more, maybe a little, like a few, you know, a few weeks, 3 to 5 weeks, I was fully red-pilled, at least on race. And I thought that, and this is interesting also in hindsight, so many things in hindsight, you know, appear totally different as your views evolve. But at the time, I was really interested because it's a big argument, like, is there such a thing as institutional racism? And the conservatives will say, no, there isn't, because you can explain it based on the choices that they make. And that's why the IQ disparities appeal to me so much, because they provided a satisfying explanation for the disparity in achievement. In hindsight, I think that there's much more to that. And I think that IQ is actually an immense oversimplification of the issue. I think that if you took whites with an average 85 IQ, which is the same as the American black average IQ, and you selected specifically for even 80 IQ whites, like lower IQ than blacks, they would still build a much better and different society than American blacks. It's not just IQ. There's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah.
But at the time, that was what was the initial red pill. Now, on the JQ, this is very interesting. A lot of Jews, you know, when they encounter people saying Jews are disproportionately represented and they do all these bad things in society, they react to that very negatively. Like, oh, this is Nazi propaganda and these are just all the things that were used to persecute us in the past. But to me, even when I was 14, when I was very young, I'd say even before that, but this is like when I really remember me exploring this topic, I noted very heavily how Jews were the ones who were, at least, again, overwhelmingly represented in spearheading degeneracy. I don't just mean in general supporting it, because there were a lot of whites do, but people really pushing the envelope of what's acceptable in society when it came to gay rights is a great example. Jews were at the forefront of that. There was some article by some guy, some pastor, or some, I forgot the name of it, but he was arguing like Jews are involved in this. And a lot of Jewish friends were like, oh, this is terrible. How could he say that? And I remember reading it and like, this seems fine to me, even back then. And I recognize that we really are involved in, whether it be Marxism, whether it be feminism. You can go down the list of intellectual movements in European history. And by European history, I mean more broadly, its colonies as well, such as America. But if there's one thing we are darn good at, it's building successful intellectual movements, for whether it's the Frankfurt School or whether it's libertarianism. On the other hand, you know, there is, and this is something we will talk, as you know, I'm sure we're going to talk plenty about the JQ here, but there is this tendency for Jews, the first reaction is to say, yes, Jews are more involved in multiculturalism, in degeneracy, in all these things. But on the other hand, we're also overwhelmingly overrepresented in things like literature, art, science, all the good things. And I say, yes, that is true. If you look at minorities throughout European history, Jews have contributed in all of these fields also much more than you'd expect them to for their size. But on the other hand, I'd say that simply saying people only notice the bad things and there's good things too is also an oversimplification of the issue, because you have, you know, Jews are raised with a very strong sense of, whether they're religious or not in many cases, with this very strong sense of, you know, moral righteousness. And I think that if it's based on traditional Jewish values, that can be very healthy, because traditional Jewish values are very conservative. But on the other hand, when they become perverted and they go into all these things like we're fighting for diversity and equality, then it can become very dangerous, because you have all these people saying things like our sense of justice for all these minorities, for all the gay people, for all the transgender people, that comes out of our Jewish values and Jewish. I'll give you a great example of a particular Jewish value. There is something called Tikkun Olam. I'm sure you've seen that phrase before.
Yes.
It literally means fixing the world. Now, that has a very specific meaning. One of the European Jewish sages was asked about this. I forgot which one it was exactly. But he was asked what it meant to do Tikkun Olam. He says, you have to start with yourself, because you can't just fix the world. It's unrealistic. You start with yourself, you move on to your family, and you try to establish stable and healthy communities. And he said, that's how you're going to fix the world, from a bottom-up approach. But the Tikkun Olam of progressive secular Jews is exactly the opposite of that. It's, we're going to totally destroy the culture, like the Frankfurt School. And even though many of these Jews don't identify directly with or even know the role of the Frankfurt School in history, it's very similar dynamic where we are going to advance all of these things in society. It's Tikkun Olam. And I just sit here going like, oh, you can imagine how I feel.
Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
It's a huge problem. And I don't think it goes away just because we contribute a lot of good things to society. Like mass immigration in the US, I don't know the history of mass immigration in Europe so much, but in the US I've studied it extensively. The 1965 Act, while there were other interests, like business interests, like Democrats who wanted votes, the push for it on the hand of the ADL, of the AJC, of a lot of these Jewish organizations and senators in Congress, like Javits and Seller,
that's right.
It would not have happened without them. I don't think you could have passed the Hart-Seller Act even if you just had business and Democrat interest, because you need that extra, this agitation component from a social perspective, the groundwork that was laid by Boasian anthropology and other intellectual movements. So yes, absolutely. Jews have a disproportionate role of, let's say, pushing mass immigration. That's the biggest one I think concerns you right now, but also other things like degeneracy. And let me say this. I remember a lot of times, it's not exactly the same, but I saw this tweet recently, which I thought was very insightful. And it said, it shouldn't matter to white people who just want stable and healthy communities why black people are committing disproportionate crime. It doesn't matter to them, even if it's true that there's a history of oppression that causes these bad cultures. All they know is that their neighborhoods are becoming trash and that their kids are going to have a less secure future. And it's like, yeah, you can make a similar comparison about Jews, which is some white guy living in the Midwest who's never met a Jew. All he's seen of Jews is on the radio and TV directly opposing his own interests. All he knows is that they're telling him that he has to accept multiculturalism and immigrate. He's probably a racist for voting for Trump. And like, do you think that if some minority, and we'll use Muslims as an example, if all you heard about them, you know, on radio as a Jew, I present this to Jews, is, you know, speaking against your interests, you probably feel not very positively towards that group.
Yeah.
And that is the dynamic that's going on here. There is overreach in anti-Semitism, but some of it is just a normal reaction that you expect from people being exposed to negative activities. And negative attitude.
Why do you think, I mean, so many Jews such as yourself stay quiet on this issue? Other Jews that oppose mass immigration and multiculturalism, they see some of these double standards. Why do they stay so quiet then? Why don't they back up Europeans and say, yeah, we're with you. We understand your cause.
Well, first of all, for me, I don't want to stay quiet. I specifically want to start a publication. And I, I'm I was planning to, let's say, talk about this a little later, but I'll shill for this now. It's not up at the time. We have a few articles that are going to go up. We're going to go with a website name. It's going to be called Jewish Alternative. And the Jewish Alternative means both an alternative to the left-wing diaspora and an alternative to, let's say, Jews who are also staunchly anti-Israel. I'll touch upon that later. It's a very big deal. But both Jews who are, you know, against white interests in the West and Jews that oppose our own nationalist interests in the Middle East. And I have a friend. I'm going to also shill for him here, too. He's going to be starting this publication with me. He's also contributing. His name on Twitter is Ari Ben Kanan, at Ari, A-R-I, underscore B-E-N-C-A-N-A-A-N. We're going to be writing articles together. So I don't plan to stay quiet. I do plan to stay anonymous for at least as long as I need to. But I want to get as many Jews on board with this. I think it is time to speak out. On the other hand, I think that, and this is what you'll find, a lot of Jews, when it comes to an issue like Israel, where they perceive certain crimes being committed against the Middle East by Israel, they will speak out. They see that as a serious injustice, and you have all these Jewish organizations. But a lot of Jews, I think most of them, are not even aware of the sort of double standard. And those who are don't see it as a systemic thing. They just think like, oh, well, there are Jews who have double standards. But they don't know it's perceived by the alt-right this way, or that there's a growing discontent with it in the West. And here's another dynamic I think a lot of people are not aware of. Some of these organizations that people call the organized Jewish community are this conglomerate that represent the interests of many communities. And these subset of communities, while many of their members might be conservative, they use these organizations to lobby for legitimate interests for them. And then these umbrella organizations end up lobbying for multiculturalism. And no one agreed to that down the chain. That's also something I want to fix. But while we're on this topic, I actually want to break down the demographics of Jews for you in America and show you the different attitudes that they have and how they relate to each other and how they relate to the West. Because I think that's something that a lot of your viewers might appreciate.
Let's do it.
So you have, on one hand, Orthodox Jews. Now, Orthodox Jews alone are not even one unified group. One of the things you'll find repeatedly is that Jews are actually, in terms of ideology, they're the most diverse and fragmented group. There's this sort of assumption, maybe it's not an assumption, maybe it's just an oversimplification the way people have to talk about it on the alt-right, because it's not practical to break it down every time. But there is this tendency to see Jews as this very unified community or this unified people. And I think nothing could be further from the truth. I think that Jews are one of the most fragmented groups that there are. So Orthodox Jews, they tend to have, you know, the same voting patterns in many ways as, you could say, white evangelicals. They vote overwhelmingly Republican, they're traditional, and they're sort of implicit on race in a way that white evangelicals might be, where they're not openly racist or red-pilled or anything like that, but they do understand, you know, this influx of Islam is just a disaster. This is not going to work. But they are a minority of Jews in the West overall. I think there's something, I don't know the exact figure, I'm sure you can look up, there's numbers of this. There may be 20% in the U.S. tops, I don't know, but it's definitely a small minority. Beyond that, you have Reform. Reform is a movement that was born in Germany in the 19th century. Or 18th century, I can't remember right now. But Reform is also like a very liberalized version of Judaism that takes away many of its central precepts. And they are also very liberal. And then you have secular Jews who are also overwhelmingly liberal. And that's why you end up with voting patterns like 70 or 80% for Hillary Clinton in this last election.
Yeah.
So first of all, I think the primary community that you can target are Orthodox, that I can target, are Orthodox Jews, because they're the ones who are the most germane to these ideas, because they're already traditional, so it's a much smaller leap for them to make. On the other hand, I think that, for example, my friend Ari that I told you about, that's his Twitter handle, he is secular, for example. We can make outreach to those communities as well and convince them that, you know, moving is a good thing. Moving to Israel and embracing nationalism is a good thing, and also to be friendly to Western interests. So it's not just something that I think is exclusive to the religious community. But then within Orthodoxy, you have many different groups. You have the ultra-Orthodox, and even these are, you know, fragmented. Like, we don't agree on anything, right? But within Ultra, if you look at a map of New York in voting in the 2016 election, so you'll see Staten Island is like this anomaly. It's all red, not because it's Jewish or anything. It just happens to be a red part of New York. But while on the island of Long Island, which includes Brooklyn, you'll see the small Jewish enclaves. Like these are the guys who wear the traditional garb that you'd see in alt-right memes that caricature Jews. And the irony here is that these Jews are the ones who are the least likely to actually advocate for mass immigration. Like I can't.
I've heard
think
that.
Yeah, it's funny because the Jews who actually do these things are the ones who are probably not religious or at least on the very leftist spectrum of orthodoxy.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll see these little red enclaves in like Borough Park and Crown Heights. So that's very ironic to me. Also, you'll find that some of these, if you really start going into the fringes, they actually become far left again, not on mass immigration, but on issues like Zionism. Like Satmar is a subsect of Hasidic Judaism. They are staunchly anti-Zionist. They're like, this is why people hate us, because of Zionism. And they're like true Jews who are religious, oppose that kind of thing. And they're just supposed to be a loyal diaspora people. But those the politics that, you know, really religious Jews are concerned with, for vast majority part, are on the local level, pertaining to their educational interests, pertaining to their community interests. They don't really care, and they would never spearhead degeneracy, and they don't really care about mass immigration either way. So the people who really push for mass immigration, and I think I've discussed this with Reinhardt privately. He works for you. He sent me this movie called Defamation, and this rabbi there was saying that fighting.
I know it well. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't even agree with everything in that movie, but I thought there were very interesting things there. Like fighting anti-Semitism or doing things like diversity or promoting that as a part of Jewish identity, that is something that secular Jews sort of need for their Jewish identity, because they don't have a healthy relationship with Jewish identity as a sort of positive thing of continuity and nationalism. For them, it's just they're this historically persecuted and oppressed people. So the core of their Jewish identity is fighting anti-Semitism.
That's become their religion.
Yeah, it has. And actually, I was raised on this as well. I was not raised personally. I will say this one thing that I'm very happy with my parents about. I wasn't raised with a persecution complex. My dad told me a lot of these Jews, and you can see the polling in the U.S. It's really tragic. They like, what does being Jewish mean to you? It means remembering the Holocaust. Like, you're going to remember probably the lowest point of our history as the most important and central point. Like, that's ridiculous. And not just that, also the history of, let's say, Tsarist oppression of Jews, the Inquisition. Like, you have to imagine if Europeans, like you, as part of your identity, all you looked at was the Muslim slave trade, the occupation of Spain, the conquest of Europe. Like, that was what your identity was centered around.
Yeah, or me being Russian, the Bolshevik, you know, slaughter of Russians. Yeah, my family was caught up in that, yeah.
And like that's a terrible way to think of your identity, to ground your identity. And it just leads to this endless victimhood complex, which is really not a good thing. And that's why a lot of these Jews, in the same way, many of them sympathize with our own enemies of nationalism, because they're just one more oppressed people. And you find it spilling over into that.
Yeah, I highly recommend for people to go watch the documentary called Defamation. In one portion of the film, they follow a group of Israeli high school students on a class trip to Poland where they tour Auschwitz. And you realize the level of paranoia and fear they're taught to have about Nazis from a young age. At one point, this nice old Polish man, he tries to have a friendly talk with one of the Israeli girls, and she freaks out, thinking he's insulting Jews and is possibly a Nazi. And later on, they hide in their hotel rooms because they think Nazis are out to get them. So someone is teaching them this, and it can't be healthy growing up thinking like this.
No, it can't. And also, I remember specifically relating to that scene, because I had gone through, not in terms of the resentment part of it, but the part where she says, I don't feel anything. Like, this happened so long ago, and I'm supposed to be crying, and I'm not crying. I visited those sites in Europe as part of not only a school trip, but also on my own with my family. And I remember not that I think that there isn't a value in knowing your own people's history. Like, you should, as a white person, I think it's important to know about the Bolshevik Revolution and about the conquest of Europe. But on the other hand, it's not, again, it's just not healthy to focus on that or see it as a primary part of your identity, or the, yeah. the the main part of your identity.
Now, we have to talk about your thoughts on Jews in European history, especially regarding expulsion from so many places.
Yeah, so I think that this ties in very much to Zionism, because the Zionists noticed the cycle. The Jews, if you go to Wikipedia, you'll see, you look up a history of Jews in Europe, there's one picture there, which I think is very useful. It shows a visual diagram of all the expulsions of Jews in history on the European continent. Yeah. And the Zionists noticed, like, you can blame whoever you want. You can blame the Europeans, you can blame the Jews. And I see people engaging in overreach on every side. Like, it's all the Jews' fault, everything that happened to them, they had it coming. And then I see Jews who, like, they're not even willing to really look into the history to see, like, maybe even if it went too far, people didn't resent you for no reason. But the Zionists were like, okay, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. This can't continue. This cycle where we're living in another people's continent as a minority with a fundamentally different identity, it's never going to end. It's just going to continue. And that's Zionism, again, is a reaction to diversity and proximity going together. They realized that was a recipe for disaster. Particularly groups, I think, such as Europeans and Jews. I think some groups can exist in some way, like, there are varying degrees of how groups can coexist with each other. I think Europeans and Jews, ironically, even though you can keep it stable for a large part because they're high IQ groups, they're successful groups, but it almost never ends well. The time of an exile in Europe or part of the diaspora in Europe not ending with the expulsion or not ending with pogroms or not ending with some sort of really bloody event is by far the exception. Overwhelmingly, the history of Jews in Europe is an awful history, even despite our accomplishments. And the Zionists said, no more. We are our own people. We need our own land. It was in many ways an attempt to normalize Jews, to make them just another people with their own country. You can find quotes by Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky is actually one of my favorite Zionists. He said, like, look at these Polish people. They have a land and that goes back. Think about the attachment that they have to it. That must be something so beautiful. And I envy them immensely, he said. And Jabotinsky also, you know, he made a statement in 1937, I think it was, where he said, eliminate the diaspora before it eliminates you. And I'll give you another quote. Ben Gurion, when he was asked, he was the first prime minister of Israel, for those of you who don't know, and one of the early Zionists. He said that if he had a choice between Jews in Germany leaving to Britain and all of them surviving, or half of them coming to Israel and the other half dying, he said that he'd prefer half of them coming to Israel and the other half perishing. Like, this is how radically anti-diaspora they were. They're like, Jews need to get out of Europe. No good can come of this in continuity. And you'll find this strange alliance throughout history between Zionists and anti-Semites. And I think that the comparison that came up recently that I learned about, and I didn't even know about this, I was watching Richard Spencer's Texas A&M speech. One of the questioners, who was very much against Richard Spencer, had Garvey on his shirt. And Garvey was working at the time, he was dialoguing with Madison Grant, who was open about, you know, very racial immigration policies. Garvey wanted to send he was a black man who wanted his people to go back to their home continent. So I don't always like the comparisons between us and blacks for a number of reasons.
Of course, yeah.
But just on the very basic level of Jews being a diaspora people that really should live in their ancestral homeland.
And of course, I know this is one that some Jews don't like to talk about, but also the transfer agreement. Hitler actually helped set up the state of Israel.
Yeah, initially. And then that went wrong. That didn't exactly end up very well. But on the other hand, yes, initially the Germans did want to just transfer. There were also many other problems there. Like there was a blockade on immigration. The Ottomans and the British during that century weren't big fans of continued immigration because it inflamed Arab relations. And there is, during the 20th century, there were a lot of hurdles to Jews coming to Israel. But that is no longer really the case. Now it's encouraged. Now we have entire organizations that incentivize it with funding. So those conditions no longer apply. In 1967, for example, Not the war, I know. The war happened in 67. But there was this Polish incident. The politician there, his name was Władysław Gomułka. And a bunch of Jews were expelled from Poland, and they came to Israel. And the Jews there sort of, you know, welcomed them and like, yeah, this is, come to, okay, you were expelled from Europe, but this is your home. Like, this is where you should live. So that, you know, I think that a lot of people talk about, like, anti-Semitism because they think about Jews as having to be a diaspora people, continuously having to be a minority in another people's land. I say, why? Like, we've tried this many times. In the U.S., we're still doing pretty well, but what makes you think that the cycle will never come back? Like, it could. It could. I don't think it will happen soon. But you really should not be living in the diaspora. You should be living in your homeland.
Now, what do you think also was difficult for European Jews? I mean, they blended in with European society. So what was difficult for them in Europe?
Well, I think that actually you end up, there was one Jew that was remarking in some article about the history of anti-Semitism, where he talked about how before we use these leftist paradigms for, you know, subjugation or oppression, where we think of people with the most downtrodden social positions, like blacks. And that's what we think of when we think of oppressed minorities. But he said Jews, before every time that they get expelled or genocided or pogroms or anything like that, they're actually one of the most successful and well-integrated minorities. So this is the great irony, I think, that a lot of Jews, you'll see this even very closely before the war, they were making statements like, you know, Berlin is the new Jerusalem, and we have a great life here. And they were trying to, many of them were just trying to assimilate, and they thought they could be German. But they can't. Jewish identity is one of the most, I think, powerful and internally enduring identities. I would say even more so that, like, you see this contributing to our ethnocentrism, contributing to our, like, embattled minority status, as Kevin MacDonald likes to say. I think that Europeans are able to lose their identity or lose their consciousness of their identity much faster than Jews are.
Unfortunately, Jews, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think for us, that's something that's there, and it's much harder to extinguish.
And some of that is probably there because of, you know, expulsions. And
yeah, I'd say that like anti-Semitism definitely contributes heavily to that sense of Jewish identity. You'll even see people like Alan Dershowitz. Like he, I think in a debate with Meir Kahane, which was something very interesting if you'd like to watch, between like a hardcore right-wing nationalist Jew and between like a liberal sort of Zionist, if you ever want to check that out. But Dershowitz was quoting someone else, I forgot who. He said, as long as there's anti-Semitism, there will always be Jewish identity. So there's also like a trope that runs through religion. It's like even if you try to assimilate into European society, the non-Jews are not going to let you. Like they're going to remind you that you're not one of them.
I mean, it's pretty clever to come up with a word to be able to protect your people from any kind of criticism. I wish Europeans had a word like that. You know, it's become so powerful, right?
I think TRS is starting with that kind of thing. I listen to Fash the Nation. I listen to TRS Radio.
Nice.
And they said that the word anti-white might work for that, might work as a way to, because it puts a lot of leftists on the defensive. So if that's a tactic that works for you, you know, enjoy it. But I just think that there's definitely need for nuance when thinking of anti-Semitism. And it's not useful to just think of, you know, they're going to eternally resent us, and they're going, like, you have to really look at it throughout history. And one of my, I want to learn more about European history because I'm very involved in the current era in the most recent century of Jewish history in European colonies. But who knows what happened, you know, back in 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, I really want to learn more about. There's a lot that I don't know and that I'd really like to explore.
Now, I have to ask, because everyone's going to want to know, what do you think about, you know, a lot of people, there's a lot of different conspiracy theories flying around about Jewish elites. You know, you're familiar with the work of David Duke. What do you think when you hear about some of those ideas?
So personally, I've actually watched a lot of David Duke's videos, and I read Occidental Observer by Kevin MacDonald regularly. I've chatted with Kevin MacDonald, I've corresponded with him, I've talked to him face to face actually for like a good half hour. I find him to be, even though I disagree with him on some things, like what he said about Jews doing engaging in eugenics, I think that's, there is some narrative overreach. But on the other hand, I think Kevin MacDonald has made a very good attempt to be objective despite everything. Even if I don't agree with his characterizations all the time, like Palestinian dispossession or other matters on Israel, his documentation in Culture of Critique and other works is very good. I do find David Duke to be significantly less... I don't want to impugn his personal motives. That's not what I'm trying to do here. But I think he has a much less accurate picture overall of Jews. And much of the rhetoric that he engaged... For example, the whole Jewish supremacist and Talmudist meme that's sort of been propagated by his wing of the alt-right, it fundamentally neglects that the people who are pushing multiculturalism, they are very often not Jewish supremacists. That's the greatest irony. Like, you could call me, I think, much more accurately a Jewish supremacist, as someone who thinks that Jews should have their own exceptional nationalism and Jews should be dominant in their own society. But someone who's left-wing and living in America, you know, part of that attempt is actually to be like all the other... to be non-exceptional, to be universalist, maybe not towards whites, but towards other minority, and to see their struggle as just one more in a number of other struggles. So I think the Jewish supremacist memes is actually quite ineffective when you're trying to engage with Jews at the very least, because they don't even understand. Like a liberal Jew, you call them a Jewish supremacist, they don't even get it. And they're not Talmudists. They're likely to see the Talmud as some cultural relic. Like even these pro-Israel liberal Jews in Congress, you could point to, who are generically pro-Israel and even bordering on neoconservatism, they are not Talmudists in any meaningful way. They see the Talmud as, you know, some historical document that's only valuable as a study of history and Jewish culture, but doesn't have any ultimate theological significance. So that's why, and also the concerted efforts to destroy Europeans. There have been very specific instances where you can find like Marxist Jews openly talking about, you know, what you would call white genocide, which is we're going to encourage mass immigration and mixing. But I think that overwhelmingly, those attitudes are not seen as consciously trying to destroy white society, even if that is their consequence. I think that those specific and conscious motives are more isolated than Duke's rhetoric makes them seem.
Yeah,
I'd be happy to...
I was thinking in terms of certain Jews too, such as, you know, Soros. I know he's an odd one. We could talk about him, but Barbara Spector, Noel Ignatieff, Aneta Kahani. I know you know these individual Jews, and they're really pushing immigration in European countries, claiming we must be multiculturalism and multicultural in Europe. And Barbara Spector actually said Jews were going to be at the center of that. So what do you think of her?
Well, if I'll go through a few of those figures. I watched the Barbara Spector video, and the first time I saw it, I was already red-pilled. And I just had to take a few deep breaths. Like, when I think of America, is its own little situation. But Europe is a much smaller continent. The historical invasions of Europe are much more precedented and consciously carried out today by Islam, for example. Europe is in a much more dire situation than America, I think. And to see someone like Barbara Spector, again, she's a conservative. By conservative, we mean the religious denomination, which is like the not Orthodox, it's the left of Orthodoxy. She lives in Israel with married to this rabbi who has this synagogue in Sweden. And she is telling Europeans that they need to become more multicultural. It's like you expect people not to resent you, Barbara. Like, I can't help you. Like, I'm sorry. Like, you can say what you want, but you can't be surprised when people are going to resent you for telling them that they should give up hegemony of their own lands the way that any other people are entitled to, that they have to destroy their own continent and what is their ancestral homeland. It's insane. It really is. And Barbara Spector really should be ashamed of herself for pushing multiculturalism in Europe. On the other hand, you have someone like George Soros. Like, Barbara Spector, she'd push multiculturalism in Europe, but she wouldn't push multiculturalism in Israel.
Now, what do other Jews think about her? I mean, when she's sitting there trying to speak for all Jews, what would you say if they watched that clip?
Oh, so I should introduce that by saying one of the biggest tropes by leftist Jews is they say, Orthodox Jews and religious Jews have hijacked our megaphone as part of the organized Jewish community, and they don't represent us. But meanwhile, they have these organizations where they speak for all Jews as if they represent, you know, the Jewish community, and they do the that exact thing in hindsight. So I haven't talked to many liberal Jews about Barbara Spector, and the ones that I have actually have never heard of her because they're not really involved in this whole episode or particular junction of, you know, European immigration and Jewish influence in that regard. But the right-wing Jews that I talk to, I think you already know what reaction they would have. I can't imagine that the attitudes towards her, if you explain to a lot of these people, you know, what exactly a lot of it is denial. They don't, and just lack of consciousness about what is going on the European continent that I see in many whites. I've tried to red pill many continental Europeans, and I've had some success, but a lot of them are in full-blown denial. And I think that some of it is just that sort of refusal to even acknowledge what is going on in reality with the invasion of Europe. And that's exactly, it's an invasion. It's not a, you know, like, we're trying to all live in harmony. It's they want a piece of your land and your civilization and your resources.
And do you think possibly that there are some Jewish elites who are thinking tribally, who are constantly worried about fascism rising again, right? We got to stop fascism. And so what's one way to try and stop what they think is fascism is flood the continent.
So you've seen this, ironically, in the... I remember reading an article that was shared on Twitter about the attitudes of French Jews regarding multiculturalism in Europe. And a lot of the, I think, ordinary Jews are more worried about Islam than fascism, whereas a lot of these, like, elite advocacy organizations are more worried about fascism. There's this trope, and I see this quite a bit on the alt-right, that Islamic immigration doesn't affect Jews in Europe, and it specifically affects only, you know, whites because Jews live in more elite neighborhoods. I think that you'll find actually a similar divide between Jewish elites in Europe and Jewish ordinary people. Jews have been fleeing France systematically after their neighborhoods and had violent protests by Muslims. It's not these Nazi French people who are driving them out. It's Muslims who have come into Europe who hate Jews. And I think a lot of the Jewish elites who are pushing for multiculturalism don't even understand the struggles of their own people in that same way. So yeah, that divide is a big problem. I'll get to the dynamics of that in Israel. But yeah, I reject the concept that Jewish elites in Europe are actually looking out very often for the best interests of Jews in Europe, because there's nothing they can do, you know, to make their lives worse than importing Muslims. They might have their own, you know, vendettas. They might have their own interests. I don't network with them. I don't know them. I don't read their mind. But they are, they shouldn't be representing us. And I think that that's a big problem.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, a lot of people in the alt-right say, yeah, you're being picked on in France, but at least you can go around to Israel, right? Where can the French people go nowadays?
That's absolutely true. At least, you know, with the Muslim invasion of Europe. Yeah, Jews have somewhere to go. Europeans have nowhere to go. I mean, unless you're talking about another European colony, but those are all being invaded right now. So, and it's not like they can endlessly cease land to the third world hordes. So this, for Europeans, I think it's an existential threat. And I want to reverse that just as much as you do. I want Europe to stay white. I'll say it in very plain terms. I want America to stay white, and Australia and Canada. So we will, I think, collaborate, or at least go for the same interests when it comes to European immigration. And even this is something that I think even the alt-right is not openly willing to talk about. And I think you should push for it more. I think it would be a good idea. Openly talk about deporting legal citizens who are causing huge problems. Like, if you have an entire community of Somalis or Africans or whoever it is in Europe, like these Muslims who are occupying London or suburbs around it, you should openly talk about deporting them as enemy combatants who are destroying your civilization.
Oh yeah, we do. We talk about that.
Great.
Now, what about Soros? He's very weird, you know. What do you think about him? People say he's anti-Israel. I mean, where does he align with everything here? There's so many conspiracy theories surrounding him.
So Soros is actually quite anti-Israel. He funds this or donates heavily to the New Israel Fund, which, contrary to what it might sound like, you can't pass something like the 65 law in Israel. It just can't happen with the current attitudes in the country. But you can push for, you know, Palestinians across the Green Line to get citizenship. You can push for refugees from Africa to come into Israel, you can push for ceding more and more land, which is a much more central part of that conflict than it is, let's say, for you in Europe. But he does things to undermine Israel. He wants economic sanctions. He is trying to destroy our society just as much as he's trying to destroy yours, but I think he's much more successful in destroying yours because you don't have that the inoculation of your mind. You're still going through that pathological altruism phase. You're like, yeah, let's give away all of our lands to other people. So his activities are more effective in Europe, certainly. But I see him as just as much of an enemy, even when it comes to our own nationalism, as you do.
Now, do you have Jews that are also pushing for open borders for Israel? That they're very anti-nationalist, a lot of leftist Americans. So what is that relationship between the leftist Jew and the rightist Jew in Israel?
So the rightist Jews look at, first of all, I actually think that we really need to explain, I'm not going to go through the entire history, but the Israeli conflict has its own dynamics that are very different than mass immigration to Europe for a number of reasons. First of all, like I said before, land is a much bigger part of this conflict. And also, since in Europe, they are not, the minorities are, but the Europeans aren't, talking about it openly in terms of ethnic conflict. Like, they will talk about colonizing Europe and Sharia for Belgium, and this is the third invasion of Europe, as Sheikh Khalid Mohammed says, their women are fertile and their birth rates are low. This is our chance. Like, they talk in those terms. Yes. The Europeans are like, no, that's not happening. We just have to be nicer to them. But in Israel, they at least understand, you know, that there's a conflict for land, for resources between two peoples. Even the leftist Jews understand it in those terms. So you have, you know, the central strip of Israel, which is the eastern coastal plainland that includes Haifa, Tel Aviv. It goes south until Ashdod and Ashkelon. And then you have Gaza just south of that. And that's the primary concentration of Jewish population in Israel. About 70% of the Jewish population on our side of the Green Line exists within there. And then you have, you know, the West Bank and you have Gaza. And those territories have, I think, like 4 million Palestinians between the two of them. I don't know the exact figures off the top of my head. But those people, they want, the term that it's talked in, there's this two-state solution, where they talk about, you know, we want our state and you get your state. And the thing that's completely neglected from that conversation is a few things. First of all, their activists openly talk about how they don't want just the West Bank and Gaza. They want the entire land. And they see that as a stepping stone, even when previous leftist prime ministers of Israel have offered them the West Bank in a deal, the amount of Jews who were still in the West Bank or the settlement blocks were still big enough of a problem because they have that mentality where they want it all. And I think you'll see that for Muslims on your continents as well. It's different because we are right in the middle of their, you know, Dar al-Islam. If you look at the Dar al-Islam, which is how Muslims refer to their region of conquest in the world, you have, you know, North Africa, you have the Maghreb, which was colonized by Arabs and imperialized by Arabs, and many genocides that went on there. You know, they blame America. Like, you have to accept immigrants because you imperialized and genocided all. Like, meanwhile, you look all over Eurasia and like look at what the Muslims did, and no one asked them to take in immigrants. But they see Israel as a little cutting line between one side of the Dar al-Islam, the Maghreb, and then, you know, the Arabian Peninsula and everything to the east of that. And that bothers them very much, that there's a small Jewish enclave. And when you view it from that larger context, it's the Palestinians are just the tip of the sword of Muhammad encroaching into the little Jewish enclave that they have a problem with. But they are very triumphalist when it comes to land. And I think you'll see this once their numbers increase in a country like Britain. They're already colonizing, you know, the southern part of that island, which is London and Luton and the parts around there. Mm-hmm. You're going to see them, you know, start to demand their own state or succeed, because that's what they did in Pakistan. Yep. And this is how they slowly take over societies. Very often it's by birth rates and just utilizing your own socialism against you. It's not even, they don't even have to directly, you know, openly declare war.
Which is so weird that a lot of leftist Jews in Europe just seem to like Islam, though. They just seem to be okay with all these people flooding in.
It's no, it's insane. It's insanity. It's really, I don't even know what to say. Like, it makes me so frustrated that Jews, recently they were opening this whole thing with Islam, you know, in their own, some joint alliance between Muslims and Jews because they're both scared of Trump in America.
Yeah,
Like,
I saw
oh, yeah.
that.
But then, yeah, there's also, I think, this big fallacy where people say, you know, we're more related to Arabs and Muslims, and our civilizations and religions are closer to them in some aspects. Yes, on one hand, that is true. We're Semites like them. But the sort of enmity today that Muslims have for Jews, I think, is much more severe than anything that Europeans today have for Jews. And they haven't really grasped that transition yet. They still see, you know, the old European persecution as their primary enemy, and they haven't moved past that phase. This is what you see with, you know, the immigration attitudes. If you talk to ordinary Jews who haven't thought about these things too much, if you talk to them about, you know, opening borders, I'll recount a little episode that happened to me, which is very characteristic of this. In one of my classes, I mentioned to the professor that I'm voting for Trump, and this Jew in my class who's not religious, he said, "Hold on, hold on. How can you be, you know, against taking in refugees when we needed borders back at the time, when we needed more open and loose immigration laws because we were fleeing persecution in Europe?" And even at the time, Zionists like Weizmann said there are only two kinds of places in the world. There are places where Jews aren't allowed to be, and there are places where Jews aren't allowed to enter. But that situation, that paradigm, no longer exists.
No.
And like, yeah, and they're still stuck in that mindset of we need more open borders. Like, at this point, you're not helping yourselves. You're helping Islam, and you're helping people who want to colonize the West, because the Muslims are never going to open their borders. So essentially, you're just having the Europeans and the Americans open their borders to these hostile civilizations.
I mean, Jesus, aren't they really the richest ethnic group there is on the planet right now? So hardly persecuted, right? They're doing pretty well.
On one hand, I think that they don't see that as tying in to, you know, their whether they're persecuted or not. Again, because that never, you know, saved them in the past. So they don't see that their success as being correlated to, you know, a wall against oppression. They see it, if anything, that's like a further thing to be a victim about, because people resent you for your success. You know, I've seen this phrase that went on. It was like, anti-Semitism is just jealousy. Like, people are jealous that we're successful. And like,
No, it's not
there's a
that.
little,
That's not
there's a,
it.
there's an element, but there's a lot more to it than just that. And you really have to look at the broader picture. I'd say also, you know, when it comes to Islam, I don't think that, you know, ordinary Jews really, I'm not sure how to say this. I think a lot of them understand they might not be safer, you know, with Islam, but it's like the same sort of thought process that a lot of these liberal whites have, where on some level they might realize this is probably not a good idea, but it would be unfair to kick these people out or to not let them in because they're fleeing persecution. So a lot of it is like this, I don't use the word mind control, like, you know, they're putting chemicals in our water. Mind control in terms of the memes that you see repeated over and over in media that reinforce your and shape your concepts of society. You know, it's a soft brainwashing that happens based on what people just are exposed to in media, and they become the dominant narratives. Don't forget, like, in the 19th century, you would never find Jews who, I mean, you probably would find like a fringe of Marxists that were thinking about this at the time, but the concept that mass immigration would destroy host Gentile societies, it was a given, just like it was for Gentiles. Like, Jewish attitudes, I think, are to ahead, I use ahead in quotes, of this than Gentile attitudes. But in a time where no Gentiles were even thinking about mass immigration as something realistic, neither were Jews. Don't forget, Jews were part of the Confederacy. You had Jews like Benjamin Disraeli, who was a British politician, and he actually has a quote where, I think it's a quote that goes abandoned a lot of the time, where he was talking about white genocide. He didn't say white genocide, but he was talking about how, imagine if we just started importing Africans into England. It's like, that would destroy our civilization here. So yeah, Jews were red-pilled on race. They shared mainstream European attitudes on race, even if it didn't necessarily help them. So I think that this is something that is fixable, because a lot of it is just being marinated in a host society, which is already friendly to that meme. And if on top of being exposed to that, you also don't have that natural defensive conservatism, which is innate to people because you're not part of the people. So that also contributes to it. Another thing is that Jews are overwhelmingly not doing things like manual labor, like farming in Western societies. So that attachment to the land and that investment in it that makes people conservative, that you don't get from a desk job or from being a journalist, where you're, you know, sheltered from the sort of raw world, that also contributes to Jews being overwhelmingly cosmopolitan and more liberal, which is why you'll see, like, you know, the Eastern coastal Jews who are doing things, they're working, you know, comfortable desk jobs. They're not milking cows out in the Midwest. That's also a big reason that Jews are overwhelmingly more liberal.
Now, I want to talk about Israel. It's an ethno-state, so what can you tell us about Israel's right-wing nationalism? Give us a kind of internal look inside. And secondly, I want to know if there's a faction of rightists in Israel that are against U.S. intervention and aid.
Yeah, so a few things. First of all, I'd like to give you an overview of Israeli politics, because I think it could be something very interesting to people who want to see what politics in an actual ethno-state is like. So you have, and I'm going to just pull up, actually, the parliamentary seat. Yeah, so there's 120 seats in the Israeli parliament. It is based on a European system. So we've imported, I'll talk later about how we've imported a lot of culture of the West into Israel, and that's not always a good thing. We'll talk about that soon. And you have parties like Likud, which is right now the biggest party. It has 30 seats, and it forms the backbone of the current coalition, which is a right-wing coalition. And then you have further to the right on national issues than Likud, you have Jewish Home, or Beit Yehudi in Hebrew. And believe it or not, those two parties, which are the two nationalist parties in Israel, actually only have 38 seats collectively between the two of them. The reason the coalition works is because you have the ultra-Orthodox religious parties. Now, the attitudes of ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel is very interesting. On one hand, you have religious Jews who are very devoted to the settlement movement. They're right-wing nationalists. On the other hand, you have people who, many of them really couldn't care less if it was the British or the Arabs or the Jews that controlled Israel, as long as they continue their religious lifestyle in peace. And they vote for parties that specifically represent their interests. Those parties are willing to form coalitions with any party that will give them whatever they want. And for a long time, they formed coalitions with the leftist parties. In fact, Israel actually, for the beginning of its existence, was run by socialists. It was founded by anti-religious Marxists. And they were fighters, you know, they were strong nationalists. But on the other hand, they wanted these small systems. Many of them lived in kibbutzim, which are actually mini communes that were based on very Marxist ideas of how to build your societies. And over time, the Jews in Israel have been moving further and further to the right. There's two reasons for that. One of them is that being exposed directly to a conflict, I think, like you saw this with Brexit, people who lived in parts that had the most diversity voted for Brexit much more than like these all-white areas that never exposed to diversity and don't understand the dangers of it. Well, in a country like the UK, there's enough room to separate you between like the heavily Muslim areas if you don't live there. But in a country like Israel, which is smaller, it's like the size of New Jersey. It's a little smaller than New Jersey. No matter where you live, you are exposed to the conflict or at least to diversity in one way or another, for the most part. So it's not really easy to escape that in the same way that it is in a larger European country where those things are segregated or somewhat restrained to certain areas. So that pulls people to the right automatically. But then you also have the birth rates in Israel totally favor the right wing, because the religious people are having many children. The ultra-Orthodox people are having, they have the highest birth rates, actually, and they don't even vote for nationalist parties. And the leftist Jews who live in Tel Aviv is like the hotbed of secular liberalism in Israel. It's known for that.
Isn't it also the gay-friendly city in Israel?
Yes, it was rated something by some gay organization, like the friendliest city for LGBT tourism, not only in Israel, I think in the world, actually. So yeah, that is what they think of when you think of like the really leftist cosmopolitan area of Israel.
I've been to Tel Aviv. I've seen it.
Oh, you have? Okay,
yeah.
Great. Yeah, it's very, you know, like very, it's like New York, but more degenerate. But then you actually have other parts of Tel Aviv, and I'll talk about this part later. So but for now, I just want to go back to the other parties in Israel. So these two parties, Jewish Home and Likud, lead the coalition, but Likud with being the primary leader. And then the religious parties who don't really influence, they'll just vote with a coalition if the coalition gives them what they want. And then you have the Achilles heel of the current right-wing coalition. It's a party called Kulanu. It's purely, in terms of their platform, it's purely an economic party to help disenfranchise people in Israel. And they sort of went along with Likud, but they also obstruct a lot of the reforms that Likud wants to institute. One of the biggest problems in Israel right now is that you have a conflict between the ruling government coalition and the courts. The courts, in their current form, were very heavily influenced by one of these judges named Aaron Barak. And he really made sure that the judicial tradition in Israel heavily favors the Arabs against the Jews. At least from my perspective, I'm sure you'll find leftist Jews, oh, you don't respect democracy or separation of powers. I'm sure you know how that argument would go.
Yeah.
But they recently, for example, there was a whole, not scandal, but there was a whole thing where they wanted to, they still want to, and it's still going to happen. They want to uproot one of the settlements called Amona. And there's so much opposition to that among the grassroots right wing, but the court ruled it and the government can't even stop it from happening. So there's this judicial tyranny specifically regarding settlements and other issues. Now, this is one place where the religious parties and the ultra-nationalist parties align, because the religious parties also hate the courts for a slightly different reason, because they also impose on, let's say, what leftists in Israel would call theocracy. But the courts are one of the biggest problems. The Justice Minister, Ayelet Shaked, who's part of the Jewish Home Party, she wants to institute reforms to weaken the courts or even make it possible for the legislature to appoint judges themselves to the court, the way they do it in America, like where the president can appoint new justices. In Israel, the system is the court itself has a much more say in the continued appointment of justices. So the ideology of the court just perpetuates the ideology of the court as it is. And that's one of the reasons the court remains leftist, even though under the current tutelage of Ayelet Shaked, it has been slightly moving to the right. But Kulanu is the Achilles heel of the coalition, and they are obstructing efforts by Shaked to finally bring the courts in line with the more right-wing views of Israeli citizenship. Then you have the opposition. Now, of course, you have your Arab party. Arabs in Israel can vote if they're beyond the green line, which means outside of the West Bank or Gaza. There's 20% of Israel is actually Arab. Like, a lot of people don't know this, but it's not like we are a 95% ethno state. We're just less than 80%. So even though we do have an immigration policy that favors Jews, but Israel still has a lot of non-Jews. They have about 15 seats in the Knesset. They were originally four separate parties. One of them was a communist party for Arabs. The other ones, you had like more nationalist Arab parties, but they've come together because it's more advantageous in a coalition system. That's the joint list party. And then you have the most left-wing Jewish party called Meretz. Their leader is Zahava Galon. I don't think I have to tell you what kind of policies they advocate for. You know, they want refugees. They want to give Arabs more benefits. They want increased what they call civil rights for LGBT. Then you have the party that used to be Labor, but Labor and Nua merged, and they formed the Zionist Union, which is anything but Zionist. It's anything but nationalist, really. And it's a little more like reasonable or sane, not insane leftism like Meretz, but it's still, you know, for my taste, far too leftist. Yesh Atid is a more pragmatist center-left party, much smaller though. The Zionist Union is the biggest chunk of the opposition and represents the party that people would have in power if the left managed to take hold. But right now, you know, nothing is moving to the left in Israel. Israel is only moving to the right because of birth rates, immigration, and other things. And I think those are all the parties. There are two religious parties. There's like, you actually see this divide. between the Mizrahi, which is like the darker skinned Jews that come from, you know, the Middle East and from North Africa. And then you have Ashkenazi Jews who are the European light skinned Jews. There's actually issues of, you know, like you could call it racism within Israel. They used to be a lot worse, where some of the Mizrahi were said that they were second class citizens and there was tensions there. But overall, I think Jews have a cohesive identity, even despite the differences between the different groups. There are other categories, like there's the Ethiopian Jews, you have the Sephardi Jews who come from Spain, who are different than like the German or Eastern European Jews who form the backbone of Ashkenazi Jewry. So you'll see this within the religious party. There's a divide between Shas and UTJ. One of them is for Mizrahim and Sephardim, and the other one is for Ashkenazi. So that's another demographic divide within Jews that I didn't really talk about.
So do they marry within each other's groups? Would an Ashkenazi Jew marry like an African Jew?
So they can, but just realistically, they don't most of the time. Like, I'm actually the product of a mixed marriage. My father, his parents were from, I don't want to give too much information, but from Europe, from Eastern Europe, and my mother from even further east than the Middle East. So I'm a mix between Mizrahi and Ashkenazi. I'm half-half, personally, although I kind of look white.
But, yeah, you do.
so
sorry, I ruined your flow there. Go on.
Yeah, there's still some tensions, but they've largely gone away. Begin was the first politician, you know, as part of the Likud, who really said, you know, we have to increase Mizrahi participation in our society and really integrate them better, because there were still cultural divides, you can imagine, between people who were living in Europe for many centuries and people who were living in the Middle East for many centuries. Like there are things that needed to be reconciled. But I mean, at this point now, there's a lot of intermarriage between those groups. And I have no problem with it. I think it's totally fine that Jews, you know, mix between their own groups. And we also believe in conversion, which is a little different for us. So you could have like an Asian or a Latin person come into our in-group identity through conversion. So we have that.
Now, is there a faction of rightists in Israel that are against U.S. intervention? You know, the U.S. sends a lot of aid over to Israel. That's another complaint on the alt-right. Also, we talk about, you know, the power of AIPAC. What do you think about the power of AIPAC and all the aid coming over to Israel from the U.S.?
So a few things. First of all, if you look at the settler youth in the West Bank, who aggressively want to build more settlements in the West Bank, really want to, you know, get as many Jews living there as possible. To them, they see America as the biggest enemy in that regard, because all they hear all the time is, no, you can't do this because America is putting diplomatic pressure on us. So they really want to detach from the U.S. as much as possible. They don't want continued aid, because Kerry recently said, for example, we give Israel so much aid and they're not following through with the things that we want them to do, with the diplomatic pressure that we're placing on them to disband and not build settlements. And they're like, well, screw you, Kerry. We don't want to deal with your pressures on us. We don't want aid. To give you an idea, the Israeli military budget is $15 billion a year. And the aid is about, that's just the military budget. Forget about everything else that you need to run a country. So it's, we could easily survive without aid. And if it's going to be, if there are going to be strings attached to it, I don't want aid, because it's just something that keeps us from pursuing the policies that we want to pursue. One of the things I like about the alt-right is they really, Richard Spencer has made many odes to this, where it's like, he wrote a whole piece. It's called, Can There Be an, I forgot the exact name, but it's Can There Be an Alliance Between Jews and the Alt-Right? And he said, right now, the American right is very interventionist, but eventually it's going to get to a point where they might prefer just a hands-off approach. And I already want that. And there are many factions in Israel that are saying that. Now, it's not a politically popular position to say, you know, in parliament, because it loses you more points than it scores you. And people have tried it. But there are politicians like Moshe Feiglin in Likud who he openly is against aid. He says, why are we taking aids when our economy is stronger than America's? Why are we taking aid when it makes the Americans think that they're entitled to our internal policy? Even Netanyahu is the current prime minister. In the 90s, he was against aid, but I guess he's changed his tune on that because maybe it's more convenient for him. The other, I want to talk about the relationship between Israel and America, because I think there are both a lot of misconceptions here and a lot of valid grievances, I'd say like this. I'm against aid. I'd actually like to see the relationship between America and Israel diminish significantly. Because right now, I want to do whatever I want to do in the region. Our only serious threat, I'd say, and I think we can manage it, is Iran. And, you know, the pressure we've lobbied on America to deal with Iran has totally gone by the wayside. Like, America didn't do, if that's what we were looking to get out of them, you know, on that front. Of course, the war in Iraq, other things, yes. Right now, all America seems to be doing for us, I don't mean this to be ungrateful. I know it sounds like I'm bashing America. America has done a lot for us, and I'm grateful for a lot of the help they've given us in previous wars, and that aid has helped. But on the other hand, I see both factions within the alt-right and the rising American, what you could call white populism, who want to be less interventionist and who want to give us a freer hand. And I think that's a very good direction to move in, where Israel can do whatever it wants and America doesn't tell us what to do. I think a lot of people would be very happy for that. On the other hand, you'll find that, let's say, I want to talk about AIPAC. So I don't actually think that if in terms of the aid itself, America is losing money, because there's a lot of, you see this when you look at left-wing anti-Zionists, people who are all, they talk about Israel's war crimes, and they say Israel is a racist apartheid state. They say things like, no, the U.S. actually gains plenty of money from this alliance. Like, they give $3 billion, but they get arms deals, they get a free aircraft carrier in the Middle East. And there are other, you know, American officials who have said things like the intelligence that we get from them is worth $50 billion a year. I don't remember the figure. It was insane. A lot of people are skeptical that that intelligence is actually being used, you know, to serve American interests, which is actually something I understand. But yes, I think that a less cooperation, maybe cooperation is the wrong word. I still want to cooperate with America, but less heavy intervention might be a very good thing for us. And that's a direction I'm fine with taking us in.
Yeah, we should be doing our own things. It should be. Yeah, I know you've heard a lot of alt-right people say, and that's one thing they liked about Trump is America first, not Israel first, right? It's always every president always has to mention Israel, right? Every single one.
Yeah, the original Meir Kahana, who's like one of the most right-wing, the father of really radical right-wing Zionism, he was very strongly against aid, even back then. He died a while ago, but he was assassinated. But he already said at the time, it's 1% of GDP, and this is going to be used to dictate our own policy. Like, don't let it happen.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're the only one who wants to end aid. I also want to end aid. I think that would be a good thing.
You should work towards becoming Prime Minister of Israel one day.
I don't know if
maybe we can have like an alt-right Prime Minister of Israel one day.
With this rhetoric, I don't know if I could. They discover this interview one day in all my publications. But yeah, there's still like in Israel, actually, this is something you might be surprised at. They are not big fans, not for the reasons you would think. They are not big fans of Europeans, continental Europeans specifically, as opposed to Americans. Because right now, you have countries like Sweden, who are very much subservient to their small Muslim minorities, and also very leftist in the way they think about nationalism. So they're very against Israel. They release statements regularly condemning our products, wanting to label our products. And Israel sees Israelis, like right-wing Israelis, all they see coming out of these Scandinavian and Western European countries is condemning their own nationalism. Meanwhile, the EU, which gives plenty of aid to Palestinians, or at least tries to make things better for them in the region with some sort of indirect subsidy, you'll find that they are very anti-Israel in terms of the nationalist aspect of it. So all of these, I think that a far-right leadership in Europe would benefit us too. Even if, let's say, Jews would leave Europe, they would be like, yeah, you guys do whatever you want in the Middle East. Like, there's no reason for us to be so, you know, like telling you and condemning you for taking whatever steps you want to take in the Middle East. Because we understand that we have problems like this in our own countries with slightly different dynamics, albeit, but I think they would be a lot more lenient if we had like a far right leader.
I agree. I think it's the best thing for you, really. So I have to ask, what do you think a lot of, you know, earlier we talked about how Jews are disproportionately represented and there's a lot of Jewish elites dominating a lot of different fields. There's the tribal interest, which of course is healthy. I understand that. What is it that they are ultimately after? What is it that they want? What's going to make them happy? I mean, what's their end game?
Before I get to that, I still have a lot to say about the last thing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Can I continue? Yeah, like one of the things I think that we would both benefit from is the dissolution of the EU. Because the EU, you know, they're funding ICC suits against us.
Oh, I know. Yeah, we don't like the EU either, so we're with you there.
Yeah, so the EU and also the UN, they're very much based on these third world anti-white and anti-Zionist as well, Marxist, like Chomskyism, you could say, where they see Israel as a problem because it's a successful first world country, and that's why they don't like it. They see it as something to be exploited or oppressing the people surrounding it. Just one example is how, like, if the Palestinians, one thing that would immensely benefit them is if Israeli settlers moved in and increased their economy and expanded jobs. But I understand that they don't want that because for them, they want the land, and it's more important for them to live in poverty rather than to have Jews move in and make their quality of life better. So it's like this sort of, it's anti-white in a way. Even though we're not white, it's there, much of the same sentiment that fuels anti-Zionism is actually the same sentiment that fuels being anti-white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The UN as well is something that I wanted to, I think I mentioned that just now. But they, for example, had one or two or three resolutions against the rest of the world, and like one on Syria, or maybe none on Syria, I don't remember. Did they have any on North Korea? But it was like three for the rest of the world, despite everything going on in Southeast Asia, and about 22 for us. Although luckily, you know, Saudi Arabia and all these Arab countries, they're sitting on top of the security and the Human Rights Council. Like those countries, yeah, they're great with human rights, trust me. But luckily, the U.S. does veto that for us. That's one of the last things that I think that's going to be something that's not going to be as easy to get rid of as aid, because it's much more integrated there. You're going to have a harder time just deleting that overnight. But the UN is an institution I'd like to see either Trump pull out of. That would make me very happy. Or to just see it reformed or weakened or totally be destroyed.
Yeah, that would be better.
Yeah. Now to your next question, can you ask it again? Because I went back on a few others.
Sure. Yeah. Earlier we were talking about how Jews are disproportionately represented. They dominate a lot of fields. And you were talking about the, you know, healthy tribal interest. I get that. But what do you think is their end game for a lot of these Jewish elites? What is it that they're after?
So this is a great way to break it down for you initially. There's not even unity in this regard. Have you heard of Sheldon Adelson?
Oh, yeah.
So Sheldon Adelson actually donated like a lot of money to Trump this campaign. And I'll tell you why. Trump, someone like Sheldon Adelson, he literally could not care less what Europeans or Americans do on their continent. Like, deport all the Mexicans, deport all the Haitians, as long as you support, you know, right, or at least don't interfere with right-wing Israeli nationalism, Sheldon Adelson will give you money. That's an example of someone who would totally be willing to make an alliance with the far right in Europe. If the opportunity comes for it and they're like, we Europeans or we Americans, we're not going to get involved in your conflict. You can do whatever you want, but you also do whatever you want. That's the, let's say, path that I want to see going forward for, you know, Jewish nationalists and European nationalists in the future. But so that's someone like Sheldon Adelson, but he is kind of unique in that regard. Then you have someone else like Chaim Saban, who I think you've heard of, where he supports, you know, the right wing in Israel and the left wing in America. I'm not sure if someone like Chaim Saban really supports Hillary Clinton because he likes mass immigration or because he thinks that she was more viable than Trump. I think that if you had Hillary versus Rubio, Chaim Saban would be paying both of them. Like he would just go, he's willing to pay off anyone who he can. Like he's just looking out for his own interests in the Middle East. And he's also much more willing to be interventionist about it, where I think Adelson, he doesn't mind interventionism, but he, as you can see with Trump, who's not a neocon, he was willing to fund Trump. He funded Romney before Trump. So he's really just looking out for the interests of Israel with no regard for what happens to European or American minorities. Now, this is where there's not a unity. Even Sheldon and Sheldon Adelson and Chaim Saban, they would have more in common in terms of their interests. There are Jewish elites. I'll give you an example in Israel to show you how disparate this is. There's a Jewish group called We Are Refugees in Israel. There were 50,000 Eritrean and Sudanese refugees that made it into Israel before we built a wall before we started taking all these measures to secure our country. And 50,000 in a country like Israel, that's like 2 million for a country like, I mean, 50,000 in a population of 8 million, to give you an idea. It's some, I think it's like 2 million for a European country or for America. It's a very large amount, and they took up a whole neighborhood in Tel Aviv, which was reserved for like suburbs and families. And what ended up happening was the mayor wanted to give a school, for a successful school for Russian Jews in Tel Aviv, to these immigrants, to these migrants from Africa. This is where we were, and the education minister and the prime minister stopped him from doing that. The people in that neighborhood formed their own little militia to deal with these. Yeah, and they were condemning these people in the strongest terms. So you have this, you know, disconnect between the elites in Tel Aviv who live in their own segregated, like, all Jewish neighborhoods, and then, like, the suburbs who have to deal with the multicultural policy. That is not unique to Europe. And this group, We Are Refugees, they legally fund anything that migrants need. You know, legal advice, trying to fight the system to stay in the country, giving them housing, etc. They will do everything. So yeah, there are Jews like that, you know, Jewish elites. There are ones like B'Tselem. It's short for, you know, man was created in the image. It's like sympathy for minorities. Man was created in the image of God. They will try to go to the UN to get Israel sanctioned. Like, that's how passionate they are about destroying their own ethnostate.
Jeez, what a mess.
So,
what a mess.
Yeah. And I think many of these, that's like the extreme polarities, to give you an idea. And then you have George Soros, who, again, like we said, he just hates all nationalism, and he's willing to do anything to destroy any country. BDS is an economic sanction movement that tries to boycott Israel culturally and economically. If you're from there, from that country, and you don't renounce everything that it does, you should be deplatformed. You shouldn't be allowed to do any business with anyone. Soros helps their efforts. And also, there are many Jews involved in BDS. So that's okay, those are the extremes. But let's go for now for the centrist sort of elites in Europe. I think many of them, you'll actually find that they're just business people who have no attachment to any sort of continuity. And this is why I don't always agree with the characterization that these people are pursuing Jewish interests. I think in many cases, like, would you call it, if someone was trying to destroy white neighborhoods and just in it for the money in every way, would you say that that person is pursuing white interests? I think they're just trying to destroy society for their own personal gain. But Jews also are a disproportionate part of that elite bourgeois class. So I think you'll find business people who, again, they just don't have any regard for anything. Now, I don't know if there are people, if there are elites who are like consciously, let's destroy the West. If there are, no, they won't talk about that openly.
Yeah, I've wondered that, if it's maybe just something unconscious that they're working on, that it's not necessarily a conscious thing in their mind. But some, it sure seems like it.
Yeah, I can't really tell you, because I'm not privy to these meetings of Jews where they get around in their rooms and they're like, well, how are we going to mongrelize the West today?
Rubbing their palms.
Rubbing their palms, yeah. So I can only give you the overview of the Jewish elite that I see out in the open and that I see openly telling us what they want to do. I can't read the minds of the people behind closed doors.
Of course, and it's absurd to say, oh, just because you're Jewish, you know what all these other Jews are doing. I understand that too.
I would like to say, though, there are, like, let me tell you about the ADL and the AJC. I follow them both on Twitter, you know, and I occasionally retweet them and insult them. But like I throw quips back and forth with them. The AJC on their website, and they advocate for, I don't even know what they do for Jews. Like, I don't know what good things they do for Jews. But they have, apparently, maybe they help communities in the diaspora. I have no idea. But they do advocate for a two-state solution. They want to give the West Bank and Gaza to the Arabs. They want to give them their own. So I'll explain why that's a disaster in a second. A lot of people think, so what's the big deal? Just disengage, have your own country. I'll explain soon. But then the ADL also advocates for the same thing. The ADL says, you know, we need to give the Palestinians their own state. And the ADL is like, if we don't do this, it's going to be the end of Israel as a Jewish democratic state. They use all these talking points that the Israeli left also uses, where you're undermining democracy, you're undermining our values if you don't do all of these things for Arabs and other minorities. So, but I'll explain to you why. I understand it's very easy for someone to hear me talking about a two-state solution if they don't understand the dynamics of the conflict and think, so what's the big deal? Wouldn't it just end things? Like I said before, and this is one part of it, in among their own ranks, they want all of the land because it's just a broader part of the Islamic hegemony over that region. And they believe they have a law, for example, in the PA. Any Palestinian or Arab that in those territories that sells land to Jews, it gets executed by them. Like, they have a big problem with Jews making any headway, whether it's in East Jerusalem, which is across the Green Line, or whether it's in the rest of the West Bank. But if you look at the topography of Israel, this is something very important. Remember how I mentioned to you that the coast, which has the majority of the population, is flatlands. The West Bank is mountainous, and it's about 1,000 meters in its highest elevations. It's very, like, you can look at Google Maps. They have a decent 3D view of this. It's not a straight land at all. Gaza is flat land. Like, it continues alongside the shape of the coast. And after, we already tried this. We disengaged from Gaza. And we pulled out all the settlements from there and all the Jewish presence. And they voted, you know, we talk about, like, bigotry. And they voted for a party with an openly genocidal platform. Which, you know, a lot of Westerners... A lot of Western Jews, or a lot of even, you know, conservative Christians, they look at that and they're like, look at these people and the contempt they have for basic decency and morality. And I actually think that one of the biggest problems with our rhetoric on Israel, on both sides, is that there's a lot of these, both Jews and non-Jews, are looking at it from within a liberal framework, or like fundamentally liberal, not liberal as in, again, liberal or right-wing, liberal and the umbrella of ideologies that comprises. And they're like, you know, they see it, there's terrorism on both sides, and we have to de-escalate the tension. But you have to view it, and I think people on the alt-right can appreciate this much better than normal people.
that's not true.
But like, this is an ethnic conflict. So when they have in their charter, in the party that they voted for, that they are going to totally destroy the other people who live there, they see this as an existential ethnic conflict. So, okay, they voted for genocide. Like, I don't expect anything different, especially in their situation. That's what they want to do. Their primary concern isn't their quality of life. It's the fact that these are other people that they see as taking away their land or having dispossessed them. I think there's numerous problems with their narrative, but I'm not sure how much I want to get into that right now. The other thing is with Gaza. So after we disengaged, you know, they voted for as far right of a party as you can be, and they were sending rockets, you know, continuously into Israel for a long time. And these tensions grew, and in 2014, they kidnapped and killed three boys, and then there was a whole offensive that killed a few hundred Palestinians. I know this is like, there's this term called hasbara. Have you heard the term hasbara before?
No.
It's literally in Hebrew. It means, you know, like explaining. And there are actually whole seminars that Jews, like young Jews, sit through that like explain to them how to be an apologist for Israel. And the whole thing is done from like a liberal framework. There are these... It's very universalist in terms of the way it tries to appeal to white Westerners. And I think it's a fundamentally flawed view of the conflict, because you can never have a liberal paradigm representing an ethnic conflict accurately. That's just like when people talk about Islamic terror in the UK, it's not like, okay, terrorism and they raped some girls. Well, that's a crime and you put them in jail. This is how they do an invasion. And this is how they colonize the enemy's land. Like, that's what's going on. It's not like, well, they killed people and the judicial system is going to have to take care of that. Like,
right.
It's such a flawed way to look at the invasion of Europe and the conflict in the Middle East. So for them, you know, I'm not a purist. I don't know what your views are or people in the alt-right are. I actually don't think that an ethno-state has to be ethnically pure. We have minorities in Israel who are peaceful. We have the Druze.
Yeah, there's always going to be a small section of minorities. Yeah, and most people realize that's not going to be 100% purity. We're going to do these DNA tests and see if you're 100% Hawaiian. Exactly. It's not going to be that extreme.
Yeah. So it's not a problem that we have, and I actually don't even think, I think a lot of conservative politicians, because they're also viewing it from this liberal paradigm, they say, well, they have to assimilate. I don't think they have to assimilate. The Druze can have their own little culture and their communities in the Golan in northern Israel. That's fine. They contribute, they're peaceful, whatever. Like, I'm sure maybe small pockets in Europe that maybe you would be fine with. I don't know what the situation is as far as you're concerned. But that's not the problem. The problem is that you have a million or millions of people who believe that the land belongs to them just as it does to you. That's when peace is not possible. All you can do in a situation like that is you can manage a conflict or expel them. Frankly, and I'm going to get a lot of flack for this for maybe other people who are listening who are not maybe alt-right, but I really want to transfer them across the Jordan. They are Sunni Arab Muslims. They're indigenous to the Arabian Peninsula. And there's a country which was originally a part of the British Mandate. It was partitioned for Arabs. It's 90%, it's 90 and 98% Arab and Sunni. I forget which is which, but it's overwhelmingly, you know, their demographic. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be integration pains, but there's free land there. And, you know, if the EU and the UN, this is another ironic thing, they spend all this money trying to give aid to these refugees. Meanwhile, America is subsidizing in large part, you know, our military, which it costs money to keep up checkpoints in the West Bank. It's not a free endeavor. I don't want to oppress Palestine. Like, I don't want to keep them in these checkpoints and build walls around their territories. But that's the only thing that stops them from, you know, having intifadas with us, where they stab citizens in the street as a number of lone wolf attacks. That's the only way you manage a conflict like that. The biggest intifadas, by the way, terror is not a result of despair. This is a big fallacy. Terror, and you'll see this in the UK, that when they get emboldened, that's when they commit the biggest crimes against you, because it's hope, and it's weakening your resolve and getting things out of you. That's why the biggest intifadas were after, you know, when we try to make peace agreements with them. It's actually after we really pushed them back in major wars in 48 and 67. That's when they really left us alone. I think you need to understand that in Europe, which is like the rhetoric that, you know, remember when Trump talked about his Muslim ban? And you had these people who were like, if we don't let in more Muslims, then the ones who are here are going to kill us.
Yeah, and I know. It's ridiculous. So it's like a threat, it's like, right?
It's the exact opposite. If you play hardball with them, that's when they're going to leave you. If you deport them, that's when they will be like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's all they respond to is force. We know this.
And when the Israeli right says that, the Israeli left gets very triggered. Like, how could you say that? They're human beings just like you and me. We're not all that different. And
no, they're pretty different.
A lot of, I think I was going to mention this earlier, but I skipped over it. You'll find that the leftist Jews in Israel overwhelmingly are Ashkenazi. They're the white Jews, yeah, so to speak. And Mizrahis and darker skinned Jews are much more likely to be right wing. Progressive Jews are usually these like European Jews. I think there's something in that blood that you gave us.
Yeah, it's just so weird. It's true. It's like the whitest areas, the whitest countries, or whitest communities, always the most left and just cucked and retarded.
Yeah,
it's true.
There's something like you guys have plenty of incredible things about your ability to conquer and explore, but you also have this sick pathological altruism.
It's true.
Which really is like, you notice that we lived in Arab societies for a long time. We were never able to, no one even conceived of trying to get Arabs to accept mass immigration in their countries. Like, you can talk about Jewish subversion or pushing immigration policies. We never pulled it off anywhere else. We only pulled it off in America.
It's so true. I mean, we do have to accept some of that responsibility there for being bamboozled, yeah, and stupid.
Yeah, it's only possible with white people. And it's also like these leftist parties in Israel are overwhelmingly Ashkenazi in both the people who vote for them and the people who run them. So that's a very interesting dynamic.
Now, I know a lot of European Jews, they don't identify as white. And we've seen that there's a lot of those particular Jews that are pushing this white privilege lie. Well, why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, I'll just tell you first about like the discussions that you have among non-elite Jews, like not the ones who work in media, like general liberal Jews actually say Jews aren't white, and they aren't like, you know, the same status as someone with a last name who's like totally European and can pass for white in every situation, but they still have to have white privilege. They still have white privilege, and they still have to acknowledge that they have white privilege because it ultimately does earn them benefit in society. Then you'll see, like, these elite Jews, I really do think, like, a lot of these concepts, and this is just a broader dynamic, you have the vanguard in academia that pushes them, and then society eats them up, and they're perpetuated through memes that repeat themselves in media. They're the people who spearhead them, and the people who buy into them. And Jews have that division just as much as whites. And yes, it's a big problem. The whole white privilege thing, like one of the red pills for me actually was accepting that white privilege was very real, ironically, because, you know, they're smarter, they're more productive, and they build better societies, but not because they exploit other minorities, yeah. Just the opposite. They'd be better off if they didn't have blacks in their neighborhoods. But yeah, this, I don't read the minds of the elites. I don't know what they were thinking. Someone like Noah Ignatiev, I've read a lot of the things he's written. He might just be the kind of, you know, resentful, hateful person who really just wants to see Europe burn or European civilization burn, and revels in it. And like, that's, I think he is motivated very much by a sort of very dangerous grievance that has gone completely out of hand. So yeah, I think there is some of that. But then I think some of them, they see themselves as victims of Western and European imperialism. And that's why the white privilege thing really resonates with them. You know, I know this Jew. She worked for the Clinton campaign. She's extremely pale. She totally passes for white. And she's still like talking about how Jews don't have white privilege. She comes from an upper middle class background. It's like, well, I still experience so much anti-Semitism. Listen, a lot of the problem is that Jews actually believe a lot of these things. This is, mm-hmm. I think, something that gets ignored. And that's why a lot of the attacks on Jews from the alt-right, where they say, oh, you have these double standards. They don't even realize that they have the double standards.
Yeah, they don't even see it.
They don't see it. No, they don't. So I wish I could tell you, I wish I was privy to these meetings between elites who are not even homogenous in their ideologies themselves.
So I have to ask you, you were at the MPI conference. What did you think about the salutes and all the press that went out about those salutes, the five guys saluting at the MPI conference?
First of all, it was really ironic to me that that's the part they zeroed in on, because Mike Enoch right before that, like almost the entire room gave salutes and that wasn't recorded. That was the first thought I had. But also in addition to that, you know, the everyone I talked to, people were very, very nice to me. There was one exception to that. So that's the first time I've ever experienced anti-Semitism in real life. There you go. At the NPI conference, one guy who was trying to be intimidating. Everyone else, you know, they took interest. They were really good to me. They wanted to talk to me about what I think and why I'm here, what I thought could be done about the situation that both of our peoples find themselves in going forward. And then I talked to Richard Spencer. You know, at the end of his talk, I went over to him. Even before that, I introduced myself to him. And I told him I really liked his approach, where he was willing to talk to other identitarians from other people. And I had no issues with him. I maintained some correspondence with him and even Kevin McDonald. So it's. And I'll tell you another thing. I was quoted by a particular newspaper at NPI. I don't want to say which one. I was quoted anonymously. And they totally botched what I said.
Of course,
like,
I already don't
trust the media, you know, as it is with the whole election. But after seeing that, it's like I was at an event. I saw how it was reported on, and they totally misquoted about half of what I said to make it seem quite different. So the fact that they opened that clip with a strong applause line, Richard even said himself during the speech, Trump is not the best president. He supports affirmative action. He wanted to desegregate clubs. He's ironically the most Zionist president that like we've ever had. I'll actually get to that, like Trump in Israel. I have to say, I'm thrilled about Trump as a presidency, not just because of his domestic policy. I'll get to that later. But back to the NPI conference for a bit. So he's like, Trump, Richard doesn't think that Trump is actually like some God Messiah emperor. He realized that he's a very flawed leader who just is bringing people closer to the alt-right in many ways, and he's a stepping stone. But Richard knows that like, it's such so absurd. They opened up with the applause line, and if you hear that, if you don't see all the energy that was in that speech, I thought it was an excellent inspirational speech. If you go forward and you say, well, you know, this is there's a build-up, and then you end the build-up with an applause line, and you say, "Hail Trump, hail our people." Like, I wasn't scared or intimidated when I heard that there. You know, I wore my kippah, by the way. I wore the religious thing. So it's not, people knew I was a Jew. My features are very Jewish. It's not like I was treated well because I passed. and you know, so if you were there, you know that it was like really not a Nazi party where they were talking about genocide. It was, you know, an applause line at the end of a speech. They opened with it intentionally because it's like scary, actually. If you just open that audio clip on YouTube and you hear a booming voice and a bunch of people, like, you can get, like, intimidated by that. You can imagine.
Plus, you also know the alt-right. You know their sense of humor, and you know how it's become like a big middle finger to the establishment. It's the one thing that gets people so worked up. They just can't handle that salute.
Jared Taylor and Richard Spencer were talking about this, not separately. It's a generational thing. Like, a lot of older people react to it in a way that younger people don't. So it doesn't faze me that much. But people, like, a lot of the older attendees, they freaked out about the salute in a way that, you know, the younger people didn't. Maybe, you know, you could say you're just trying to appeal to the younger people. But I think a lot of, yeah, like, the older demographic still has very strong negative reaction to that, because they, you know, maybe lived through times where that was more. Listen, I think Mike Enoch actually makes a lot of good points where he says, you know, you guys are not strategy experts, and everything you said that was too edgy, it actually helped. This was played all over TV. In a way, I am projecting, because it makes my life as a Jew trying to build bridges with the alt-right a lot harder. But maybe it is something helpful. I don't know. I can't pretend that I'm an expert on strategy.
Now, if people knew that you were there, would you be attacked by other Jews for it? And if so, why? If you're trying to make bridges with people like us, I mean, wouldn't that be seen as a good thing? Shouldn't that be seen as a good thing?
No, because you guys are Nazis, and anyone who even tries to associate with you. It's funny. I have Jewish friends who are literally communists, like I don't use that term lightly. They're actually self-identified communists, which is an ideology that killed way more people than Nazism by far. And
definitely
the hammer and sickle is quite normalized in our society. It's even commended on a lot of campuses. It's like you're fighting for the revolution, even though your ideology is really in power. But the swastika, in comparison, people react to it much worse than they do to the hammer and sickle, even though the numbers alone, like.
And the swastika is ancient too, by the way, way before National Socialists.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think that enters their thought process. I personally wouldn't use either one of those symbols, because I have nothing to gain by using those symbols. And I'm not like a.
Yeah, then, this is now. So we have to move on. Move on. Can't live in the past.
But basically, being at an event and then seeing how the media reports on it afterwards is rather incredible, because you know the media is dishonest. If you're one of us, you know the media is dishonest. But it's nothing like seeing firsthand the kind of tricks that they use. There was actually a New York Times reporter that I was corresponding with. He ended up writing an article about the NPI conference, and he left me out of it. You know, he said he would. I don't care. I'm not bothered. Like, I'm actually happier that he left me out in the end, because he probably misquote me or something.
Yeah, but he did, just because of, think of how powerful that would be, that a Jewish guy was there. And he says, I was treated well, and I saw it, and it was all fun. I mean, they would never print that. Of course not.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't really do anything to advance their narrative. But what are you going to do with the media? Like, I don't know. I think we just have to keep attacking them for being totally flagrantly dishonest.
Yeah, definitely. One thing you said you did want to mention before we wrapped up was Trump and Israel.
Trump on Israel, he represents a paradigm shift, because he's not a neocon. He's like, we don't have to do these insane wars with Iraq, or we don't have to bomb Iran. But he, on the other hand, he said things like, you know, he's fine with settlements. He is okay with Israel doing all of these things. I don't know if you saw the recent news where, he appointed this guy Friedman to be ambassador of Israel. Friedman is more right-wing than both Trump and the Israeli government on Israel. Like, that's how, this is the guy he picked. He's like an op-ed columnist for a very right-wing site. And here's what he said. I would never even use this rhetoric. I am not bold enough to talk this way. He said left-wing Jews, like the ones at J Street, are worse than the Kapos. Kapos, just so that you know, for those of you who don't know, it's the Jews that worked with the Nazis to oppress other Jews. He's like, left-wing Jews in America are worse than Kapos. Because the Kapos, you know, they were looking out for their family. They didn't want to die. They were under duress. But these leftist Jews in America, they're comfortable condemning us from the comfort of their couches in a first-world country. Like, they're worse. Like when I heard that, I was like, wow. You know, I wouldn't talk like that, but this seems like an excellent pick. I have no idea what I'm really confused by his Secretary of State pick, not because of Israel, just like I was not expecting him. I thought he would take someone, you know, with more
Oh, you
experience.
mean Tillerson?
Yeah, I have no idea what's up with that
I
pick. I
guess
just
one good thing about him is a good relationship with Putin, with Russia. That's good. Yeah, I think he chose him because as CEO of Exxon, he has a lot of good connections. He's dealt with a lot of world leaders. He can negotiate, and I think that's why he chose him.
Yeah, that's what he said. Like this guy has experience with war, but it was still a pick that baffled me a bit. By the way, I think I want for Israel, I want better relationship with Russia too. I don't see why all these successful countries have to be at each other's throats,
Yeah.
and I don't see why America and Russia have to be at each other's throats over something like the Assad regime. If you, I don't know if you've been looking at it recently. There is a decent chance that Israel will go to war with ISIS because we share a border on the Golan Heights with the conflict in Syria. And ISIS has been pouring in from both sides, also from the Sinai Desert and from that conflict. So we might have to, you know, take down ISIS in the south
Should have done
western
it a long time
Syria.
ago, huh?
Yeah. Listen, I don't represent the government of Israel. I
Oh,
don't
yeah.
dictate their foreign policy.
But maybe you'll get in there, huh? You should get in there.
I should get in there. I also have to say, like, I don't deny that Israel benefits from when the Middle East is at each other's throats. Like when Assad is killing ISIS, which is killing the rebels, which is killing the Kurds, and when Assad also wants to kill the rebels and the Kurds, like Israel actually gets somewhat of a pass along these leftist institutions because they pretend like if you just took Israel away, they're the peace in the Middle East, and they forget the war that's going on in Yemen, and they forget that the Taliban and all
Yeah,
these
they're all
things are
killing
still going.
each other too, yeah.
This is the norm for that region, for like Middle East and North Africa. I told this to my white professor, like you're projecting
Yeah, there's no
your
peace in Muslim countries either, so.
Yeah, even if we never got there. Like this is one of the most explosive parts of the world and those explosive cultures. So yeah, that's one of the biggest fallacies as well. Assad actually said recently, I think he's like, despite everything that's been going on, like our biggest enemy is still Israel. Which is funny. Listen, we can leave Assad in power. He's not going to do anything to us. He's going to be rebuilding his country for like 20 years now. He likes to talk a big talk.
And he's more
Israel.
of a secular Western government. I mean, I heard him talking about multiculturalism and praising it for crying out loud.
But it doesn't benefit the region or the US to start deposing dictators because then you have other elements that come in. It's not any better. This is just how it goes in that part of the world. But yeah, so I just briefly back to Trump and Israel. This is where I want it to move. He's not going to cut aid. I actually think it's the businessman side of him that doesn't want to cut aid. A lot of people also won't like that I say that. But Trump thinks, I think he thinks that there is something to be gained by this relationship, both financially. Don't forget that 75% of Israeli aid must be used to buy US arms. So it's effectively a subsidy for the US arms industry. A lot of people don't know that. It's not like $3 billion for free, just like that. So Trump, you know, he was trying to differentiate himself from the original candidates in the primary, where he said things like, I'll make Israel pay, because all the other candidates were like, yeah, we're going to continue funding them, and we're going to destroy Assad, and we're going to start more wars in the Middle East, and we're going to bomb Iran. And Trump was like, yeah, we're not going to get involved, and we're going to make them pay. And then afterwards, he met with Bibi after the primary, and he said, yeah, we love the relationship with Israel. We're going to keep that going. Who knows? Maybe he has other pressures on him. I don't know the internal diplomatic processes that go on with Trump and his thought processes. But that is definitely the direction that I want to see Israel go in. No more insane warmongering, but also he's going to give Russia a free hand. Give us a free hand. That's what Richard Spencer wants to do. I'd vote for Richard Spencer for president. With the exception of maybe Iran and the Russian aid to Assad, we are the regional hegemon in terms of military. We're a very small country. But we could flatten half the Middle East in an offensive, like in an offensive onslaught tomorrow.
Well, then do
Another
it.
thing.
Let's get it
No,
over with.
that's not a smart thing to do. Like, not necessarily. But also, you have like people talk about we're genociding the Palestinians. You know, I think we've shown immense restraint, and we could genocide them tomorrow. You know, we could go in and flatten Gaza tomorrow with our fighter jets, but we don't do it. So I'm not. It's obviously immoral. I don't believe in genocide, but I do believe in expulsion because I think it actually would be better for everyone involved.
Yeah, nationalism. This is why we need our separate countries. One other question I have to ask you about comes up a lot. Your thoughts on the USS Liberty attack by Israel and the bombing of American installations in Egypt in the 50s. This one comes up a lot in the alt-right. What happened?
I think that at the time, and I'm not going to be one of those people who says, you know, like, no, it was just an accident. I'm going to go for that narrative. I'm not certain. I've looked at both sides of this. There is a very decent possibility that Israel intentionally attacked the USS Liberty because they were afraid that America was going to give crucial intel to the Russians and other countries in that region. I wasn't privy to it. I don't know. But I'm not writing off that possibility immediately. But it is important to stress that at the time, Israel was a much weaker country. Israel was U.S. foreign policy was significantly less friendly to Israel. Today, I don't think Israel would be as fussed if Americans got hold of some of their crucial intelligence. But back then, they had just this hyper-realist foreign policy. And yeah, it ended up killing 150 sailors, and that's a tragedy. But I wasn't there for it. I wasn't born yet. And I don't want that. I obviously would never want to do that.
Also, what did you think of, a lot of people had this problems with this, we did too, Trump's cabinet picks. There's been some, like Treasury, Goldman Sachs guy, Steve Mnuchin, and then Gary Kahn, also Treasury, chief economic advisor. They both happen to be Jews. But why do you think he picked these Goldman Sachs guys when he's been so anti-Wall Street and elites and globalists? And what do you think?
So this is actually something that a lot of my Bernie-supporting friends were just as bothered by as a lot of my Trump-supporting friends were. They're like, he promised anti-establishment picks, and then he takes these bankers. I think that this, and Fash the Nation, I think they're right about this, that he just wants to go with someone he thinks is truly competent. And another thing is there's too much assumption, again, of collaboration, that just because you work for Goldman Sachs, you're part of this global cabal and elite that has all these shared interests.
That's true.
I don't think that's necessarily the case. There's a lot of this tendency on the alt-right to really lump together a lot of people who have disparate interests just because they all oppose your own interests. So listen, Trump at one point said, and a lot of Jews were bothered by this, like, he said, I want guys with yarmulkes to count my money. Like, oh my God, anti-Semitism. Like, oh, he loves Jews. He's surrounded by Jews, like, yeah, in his personal life.
Ezra Levant did a good video about that.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. I really enjoyed that video. I was like, I didn't even know how connected he was to Jews in his own life. And I guess a lot of that is just a professional relationship. I'm sure I think he's very philo-Semitic. Like, I think he really likes Jews.
Yeah,
and
he
likes
Israel. And Jared Kushner, too, he's being praised as the man behind Trump. I'm like, who's this guy? Some 35-year-old guy who wasn't political a year ago.
He's married to Trump's converted daughter.
Yeah, oh, I know. I know. It's the son-in-law. And I was surprised that he actually got with a non-Jewish girl because he's very into his Jewish heritage and religion.
But she's Jewish now.
She is. But I thought, you know, wouldn't they want someone who's actually Jewish blood in that case?
No, I mean, among Orthodox Jews, we see converts and normal blood Jews as just as Jewish. This is actually something that bothers a lot of secular Zionists. They're like, so you're fine with your daughter marrying some low IQ West African? And the answer to that from an Orthodox perspective is like, as long as he's a good person in other regards and cares about our tradition, yeah. It's something that would, I think, like befuddle a lot of people on the alt-right, how someone who's as right-wing as I am would take a stance like that. But it's because, we've alluded to this earlier, Jews are not really, you know, a race in the same way that whites are. Jews have their own boundaries. And there's this article recently, I don't know if you remember this, Richard Spencer gave a response to a rabbi at Texas A&M. He's like, oh, I preach radical inclusion, come learn Torah with me.
Yeah.
We are not about radical inclusion, okay? I don't know what you've heard, but we are not about radical. We're just not. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. I like that we're, you know, we have a lot of, we're very exclusive and insular.
Sure. Yeah.
But the other thing is, it's possible that one of the responses I saw to Richard Spencer was like, no, Zionism isn't racist because we allow non-Jews to come into our group through conversion. I think that totally misses the point. First of all, there's still an in-group, out-group distinction. And second of all, just because some groups define the boundaries of their identity differently than you do, it doesn't mean that they don't have an identity. Like, clearly there are very strong similar motifs that run through the pan-European identity, like the music that they've produced, the architecture, the philosophy, And all the common, let's say, things that bring whiteness of many different ethnicities together, which is why they integrate into each other much better. Jews also share a common identity based on, you know, their history, their biblical heroes, etc. So yeah, we have an identity, and the borders of that identity function differently. They're not as strictly ethnic the way they are for non-Jewish whites, but they definitely are there. And the other thing I'd say is the early Zionists were anti-religious. For them, it was all about race. Like, they didn't have this concept of conversion because they were secular Marxists, but nationalists. Marxists in terms of how they thought society should be, in terms of, you know, wealth redistribution and communal living together. But on the other hand, they didn't believe that you're just able to convert into the religion. For them, it was an ethnic people. And that's also why, for a lot of them, like, they saw, what was it? Had this concept. They were very anti-religious, and a lot of rabbis in Europe were saying things like, yeah, we can't get on board with Zionism. It's just this secular movement. On the one hand, the religious ones oppose it, and the socialists in the Russian Jewish and Eastern European Bund, you know, there was a German-American Bund that we hear a lot about. There's also a Jewish one in the Pale that also was around, and they were very anti-Zionist. They're like, no, we finally are going to be able to be integrated into Gentile society. What are you guys doing? And they're like, no, we're going to... There's one more point I want to touch on, which is that for a successful nationalist movement, I mean, this was going on since the second half of the 19th century, long before they finally established a state. They were already moving in, and life was very difficult because the British and the Turkish were still controlling that land and really gave them a hard time with immigration because they didn't want to inflame Arabs, as I mentioned earlier. But don't be frustrated. It might take you, I'm not even kidding, it might actually take you like 100 years before you're really able to make whites racially conscious.
Yeah, I know.
But our movement didn't start off with, we didn't have a state in the 1880s. And there was, a lot of people also don't know, like, the history behind Zionism in Israel. There, do you know that in the 20th century, about 850,000 Mizrahi Jews were ethnically cleansed from the entire Arab world, like the Maghreb, the Middle East? You can look up the Farhud, for example. So it was actually some of it was very bloody. And then those Jews came to Israel, and there was a lot of violence between Arabs and Jews, like where they massacred, you know, tens of Jews in one day, and then Jews started new organizations to fight them. There was aggression on, like, it was not peaceful before there was a state. The state actually manages the violence much better. So people don't, and by the way, another thing about that, because people don't realize this as well, we tried a two-state solution back in 47. That was the partition plan. And within 20 years, we had two wars of aggression launched against us. And we gave them actually much more generous borders, which they were against the partition plan because it gave us too much land, even though it's much less than we have now. So I don't trust them to have any sort of peace process that maintains a division of our land. If they want to stay, if a few of them do want to stay, they're going to have to completely accept our full sovereignty and ownership of the land. And I would say the same thing. I think that Jews and other minorities, if to the extent that they want to stay in the West, they're going to have to start to understand that they are guests and they should treat their hosts with respect.
Yeah. Well, Reactionary Jew, I want to thank you for your time tonight. I think this has been a really good conversation. We're hearing new things, a different view. You know, you're Jewish, so this has been new. I mean, this is really kind of quite shocking for us, you know, meeting a Jew who's actually looked into alt-right topics and isn't afraid to bridge out and talk to us. So it's great, and I appreciate you for being brave.
Thank you very much. Just, I want to shill one more time for thejewishalternative.com. You can follow me at Reactionary Jew on Twitter. That's one word. You can follow at Ari_BenKanan on Twitter. So, yeah, thank you very much for hosting me. I loved this conversation. I'm so glad that we're able to dialogue like this openly and, you know, to understand each other's problems as fellow nationalists and work towards a future that's less honestly, a lot of them pursue, you know, the interests without any regard for the other ones. I'm not saying that I think that, you know, alt-right should be more sensitive. I think that if we get expelled from, you know, European countries, it's not going to be the end of the world, honestly. Like, people talk about it like, oh, these Europeans, like, yeah, they'll go to Israel this time, and they probably will be under less threat. We've had entire communities destroyed in the Arab world, and we rebuilt them in Israel, and now we have our own ethno state. So I'm actually not asking for like more tolerance in white countries towards Jews. I'm not asking, you know, beyond like nonviolence. I wouldn't ask you to, you know, be extremely tolerant towards Jews in white countries. But on the other hand, to be just to recognize where interests align, and they won't always align. Sometimes they'll collide in a way that any two groups, you know, their interests collide. But I'd much rather dialogue and collaborate with the alt-right than work against them. And I'm very happy to be talking to you here.
Well, off air, he told me how he was trying to red pill a female friend on diversity, and he kept pressing her on, why is it so important? Finally, she responded, because no diversity means the Holocaust. Sadly, this comment is all too common. So we have a lot of work to do, my friends. What do you think? Can white nationalists work together with Jewish ethno-nationalists such as Reactionary Jew who genuinely understand our point of view? Let us know in the comments. And no, I am not a Jewish plant trying to subvert you. Oh, that always makes me laugh. Have a good night.